This is All Things Considered on North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Another dynamic week in the world of politics. Here to discuss some of the happenings are Rob Schofield from the Progressive NC Policy Watch and Becky Gray with the conservative John Locke Foundation. Hi.
Hey, guys.
Hello there.
State senators have approved their budget plan for the fiscal year that begins July the 1st. The Senate and House will now work toward a compromise spending plan to send over to the governor. That will be done in the next week to two. As for the Senate budget, it includes larger raises for state employees compared to what the House proposed, further implements tax cuts, and no surprise, plenty of policy. Among the provisions is a plan to move the State Department of Health and Human Services an hour away to Granville County, higher fees for hybrid owners, and some significant meddling changing to Vidant Medical Center and its relationship with the Brody School of Medicine. That's a reminder in Greenville, North Carolina. Becky, from this Senate budget, one policy provision that goes too far.
I'm thinking.
Think as long as you need.
Okay.
And you can name, if you're thinking about multiple policy provisions that could, that go too far, I would welcome that as well. I was looking for just one, but I don't want to limit you to just one.
Right, yeah, and I did have to stop and think a minute. But, you know, I think one of the policy decisions that I think goes too far is, as you mentioned, the thing that has to do with Vidant Health and changing the reimbursement rate for Medicaid, which equates to about a $38 million cut in revenue for them. This is something that has recently happened with Vidant, Brody School of Medicine, East Carolina University, some changes there. There's a lawsuit that's ensued with this. This is a tiny provision in, I mean, I think that part of the, that the general provision part of the budget is 350 pages. This is maybe a third of a page. So we're talking about all the stuff that's in there. But, you know, this is one that I think they should have just waited on. I'm not sure why they felt like they needed to put that in the budget. It feels to me like that should be something that should have been worked out ahead of time or offline. And it will be interesting to see where that falls out in the conference report. It was just in the Senate. First time we've seen it. But I think that was one that just kind of questioned the timing on it. Let things play out a little bit. See if you can negotiate something that would work for everyone before you put that into the budget document.
Rob, Senate has notoriously put all sorts of policy ornaments and distractions and things that it wants and doesn't want within budgets in recent years. That's why we're starting with this question. What policy is most inappropriate or caught your eye?
I mean, it's a pernicious tradition, right? This whole idea that we bring things, we cook things up in secret that people have never seen, may not have even been the subject of an actual bill, and then lo and behold, they just show up in a 300-page budget bill and people have to say yay or nay to it. It's a terrible way to run a railroad. You reported on something this week, I thought, the fact that we're going to cut staff for the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Isn't that in the budget bill, I believe?
A proposal in the state budget would slash the Chief Justice's funding by 50%.
Yeah, I mean, come on. Now, that's obviously that's completely driven by politics. There's a new Democratic Chief Justice who they would like to handicap. This Chief Justice Beasley is going to be running for re-election. There's not a chance in heck that that would have happened if Mark Martin were still Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. There's also special provisions regarding hog farms. We know that there's a giant farm bill that's going to make it do away with a lot of regulations of hog farms. Take us back to the 90s on that. Some of that same stuff has been slipped into the budget. That's another one I would call attention to.
What is a simple good governance change that you would offer? You can play pretend, and Becky, if you were Speaker, and Rob, if you were Senate Pro Tem, or you don't even have to play pretend. If you were going to, you know, make a little bit more of a push next year for a good governance budget practice, what is something that you would like to see that is realistic that could happen around here?
Well, one of the things that we've talked about before and have never quite gotten there, but with these provisions for specific funding for specific projects, you know, and you always go through that and you find things and you'll see something and you'll say, well, of course that's in there because it's in one of the Senate leadership's district. You know, there's just that assumption with that, but that often is not the case. And so one thing that I'd like to see is a name attached to a lot of those provisions so that we know who proposed it can go to that member and say, hey, what's the deal with this? And often when you ask those kind of questions, what at first glance might look like, well, this is a foolish way to spend money, or this isn't really a necessity. When you talk to somebody in needs in their district or special things, that circumstances that may not be available right away. Also, I think transparency is always good. And if members know that they're going to have to defend requests that they have and special provisions into their district, they might really think twice about doing that before they put those into the budget. Transparency is always a good thing.
I certainly wouldn't disagree with that. The budget was written in secret, as usual, and that's a terrible way. We shouldn't have these special provisions in there. They ought to be done away with. But the bottom line message on the budget that shouldn't be lost in all this is that the budget is way, way too small. It is taking us back. We're in pre-recession levels of investment on essential core structures and services. We are underfunding education, the environment, all the essential things that we depend on government to do to sort of keep our middle-class society running, and it's having negative consequences. We're not able to prepare for the next recession. Half of our counties in the state have fewer jobs than they did before the Great Recession. We're not investing in trying to revive those parts of the state. There's so many things that are wrong with this budget, but if I had to pick one thing that I would identify, I would say we have got to get back to a time in which we are meeting the basic core needs of the state, and this budget isn't doing that.
Philosophically, we obviously know, having had conversations together for the last 2 years, that you both are in different camps when it comes to the size of government. But I want to follow up on something you just said, Rob, as it pertains to readying for a recession. Mm-hmm. This budget, I believe, restores or puts back in $1.1, a little bit more than $1 billion into the Rainy Day Fund. Mm-hmm. Senate leadership said this week that it's not enough relative to what they anticipate needing for the next recession. How much money do you think the state does need to save, or is it something else that makes it recession ready?
It's not about so much about the Rainy Day Fund, although that's certainly important. There are so many other structures that remain torn and threadbare now that we're not investing in that are going to take it on the chin, clearly, if we have another recession, because we haven't invested in our public schools, because we haven't invested in infrastructure adequately, because we haven't invested in rebuilding the economies of counties, of our rural counties, because we haven't invested in broadband. All those things make those parts of the state and millions of individuals in our state less resilient come the next recession. They're that much closer to being living on the edge. And those are the kinds of things. We had a golden opportunity. I think we still have it while things are going pretty well. We're still in the midst of an economic recovery that dates back to the early part of the Obama administration. We should be seizing that opportunity to really, this is the time to make hay, and we're not doing it. We are going to regret it when the next recession hits and we see how quickly some of our people are suffering.
Well, I think, you know, to your point with building up that savings reserve so that we have that rainy day fund, if you will. And we know that rainy days come in the way of hurricanes and natural disasters. We've seen that. We need to be prepared for that next storm that hits the North Carolina coast. But we also know that rainy days come with economic downturns and often things that are completely out of the control of the North Carolina General Assembly or the North Carolina governor, whether it's a national thing or a global thing. And so to build that rainy day fund up, to have that money to be able to provide those services, to pay our teachers, to pay our police officers, to pave the roads when a recession hits without having to go back and ask for taxpayer money when those recession hits, I think is probably the most significant thing that this budget does. And as you said, it replenishes not just the money that was taken out of the Rainy Day Fund for hurricane recovery, but it puts even more back in, so it begins to build those reserves again to a level that some cushion and some safety.
Candidly, I'm going to ask you a question now that you all weren't prepared for, wasn't thinking about it before you came in here today. To set it up a little bit, I did some reporting on a budget provision this week that, and I think I mentioned it off of the top, which would increase the registration fees for hybrid vehicles and create a new registration fee for strictly plug-in vehicles. So that's the backdrop of it. But what I want to ask you, because we're talking about funding, and Robbie, you've used core government purposes, functions here. I think we reasonable minds can agree that these fees that are being implemented for energy efficient vehicles are not going to generate enough money for the Highway Trust Fund to fund roads and bridges and infrastructure projects that I think we can agree need attention. So my kind of off the rails, no pun intended, totally intended question here is, What is that funding source? Because I do think, and correct me if I'm wrong, one of the commonalities between you both is that we want to have good roads and bridges and good infrastructure in the state, good transportation. How are we going to fund that? How are we going to come up with these billions and billions of dollars? Somebody, and I'll just throw one on the table. You can address it or dismiss it, and then I'll be done rambling. Somebody said to me this week, you know what we need? We need a sales tax for auto parts that would be designated for the Highway Trust Fund. And I will tell you this, I will not name that person. That was a conservative who said that to me, so I thought that was interesting. Anyway, how do we fund the infrastructure issues that we need here? Is it taxes or something else?
Well, in 2013, when our economy was going great guns and we were one of the top states in the union for attracting new jobs and featured prominently in, you know, Site Selection magazine and all these top magazines, our tax code was bringing in, if we had kept the tax code that was in effect then, we'd have $3.6 billion more now for our core structures and services. That's one way. We simply need to get back to having a tax system that's fair. And keep in mind that the top 1% in North Carolina pay about 6.4% of their income in state and local taxes combined. The middle class and the poor pay about 9.5%. If we even just went, we don't even need a progressive tax. If we just went to an overall flat tax when it comes to total tax responsibility for individuals in the state, we'd have billions upon billions of dollars. But the pattern in recent years has been to slash taxes on the top, slash taxes on corporations, and switch it over to sales taxes and fees like automobile fees, court fees that have skyrocketed. All of those things are much more regressive, hit people at the bottom and the middle more. So the sales taxes, it's one thing if you broaden the base and lower the rate, but to just slap on more sales and excise taxes and fees, I don't think that's going to solve the problem.
Well, Rob and I just have a real different opinion of tax policy and the role that it plays. And, you know, one of the reasons why we have these revenue surpluses that we have is because of the economic decisions that have been made. It's not just tax cuts. It's also reining in the growth of government. It's investing in infrastructure and education. And also rolling back regulation has been a big part of our economic recovery as well. So what we've had with all of this is the economic recovery and the additional revenue and the economic growth that have been able to provide these things. But, Jeff, to your question about what are we going to do about transportation and infrastructure needs, and it's something that we're struggling with and other states are struggling with it as well, because when we set up the system of how we were going to pay for roads, it was based on the price of gasoline. And the assumption was the more gasoline that you used, the more you drove, the more wear and tear you created on the highways. And so it was kind of a user fee, a user tax, if you will, was the way that it was constructed. Well, what we've seen as automobiles have become more fuel efficient, they don't use as much gasoline, and also the amount of gasoline that you use does not necessarily reflect the amount of wear and tear that you cause on the roads. So when we have these energy efficient, when we have these electric cars, they're not using any gasoline or very little, but yet they are driving, and you know there are maintenance fees that are associated with that. So these increase in those fees, that's part of the thinking behind that, is they're not contributing to it through the gasoline tax.
Right.
So through a fee, it would be more of them paying the share of their wear and tear and maintenance on the roads.
The projection for the revenue from the fees, I believe, is $800,000 next fiscal year and $2 million the following fiscal year. That's
right,
peanuts
right,
compared to the billions
yes.
that the smart folks say are needed for road and bridge projects. So what is the source? How do we get these billions of dollars to fix roads? And something like two-thirds of the bridges in this state are not up to snuff. How do we fix
that? Right, and you know, that becomes a safety issue and yes, absolutely. Well, something that's been proposed is a vehicle miles traveled tax that you would pay, and you would have, you know, like a little box that would go in your car, and it would be set at zero, and at the end of the year, whatever those vehicle miles that you have traveled, you would be charged a tax for the miles that you have actually driven, rather than depending it on the amount of gasoline that you're buying, a tax on each gallon of gasoline. They've tried this in other parts of the country with some success. I think Oregon has implemented that. There have been pilot programs in other parts of the country. The concern with it is the privacy issue And do you really want, you know, the government to know? I mean, there's concerns there.
You don't need a box. All you need is when you do your inspection, what's your odometer in 2019? 6,822 miles. What's it in 2020? 24,000.
Right, right.
18,000 miles this year.
Or you report it on your tax return, too. Yeah, I mean, there are penalties when you lie on your tax returns. But, yeah, I mean, there are ways to do it. But, you know, it is a real question of how are we going to pay for this? Other states are struggling this as well.
And you offered one up. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have an answer. It's a complicated thing, but it's something we need to pay attention to, because as we're looking at business development, as we're looking at encouraging businesses to move here, you know, particularly with the ports, and, you know, as we invest in the ports and bringing goods into North Carolina, it doesn't stop at the port. You know, we've got to be able to get those goods across North Carolina, through North Carolina, and so what those roads and that infrastructure look like. The other thing is, as people move to North Carolina, we need to be able to offer roads that they can get to work without sitting in traffic for hours and hours and hours. Lots of challenges.
Just one small point. All the things that you said about our infrastructure and about our roads and our crumbling bridges and two-thirds of them not being up to snuff, that applies to virtually all of state government. It applies to our schools, it applies to our prisons, it applies to our parks. And all of that is a function of our failure to invest adequately over the last several years. Nobody likes to pay taxes. We wish we didn't have to, but the reality is that's the price we're paying for systematically disinvesting and taking our total state spending in this state on a downward slide over the last decade. We're spending less of our total personal income on taxes, and that's what happens. You disinvest in essential services, they begin to crumble. It would be nice if we didn't have that, you know, if we could pay lower taxes and have all of our services remain robust, but that's just not how it works.
We heard the voice of Bob Mueller this week. There was no information per se when he spoke at a press conference and took no questions. That was on Wednesday. Ultimately, he reiterated findings from the two-year investigation, saying that statute prevents the Justice Department from charging a sitting president with a crime. Mueller also said if it were clear no crime was committed, the report would have said so. The inference here is that Trump committed a crime. Concisely, yes, please, concisely, should impeachment proceedings for Donald Trump begin? Yes or no, and a quick reason as to why. Becky.
No. I mean, you know, just let this go. We've got an election in 18 months. All of this attention on this, I mean, the entire Trump presidency has been nothing but these investigations. And time again, there has been little, if anything, there to pursue. I mean, if the Democrats want to, you know, begin impeachment process, let them do it. But in my view, we just need to let the president do his job. He was elected. He was duly elected. We have another election coming up. And if you don't want to vote for him and you want a new president, then find a good candidate, run him, and let's have another election.
Wow. I mean, I think the politic thing to do is not to impeach, because it's simpler and it's less risky for Democrats. I do think that, I mean, it's patently clear that the president has lied. It's almost a certainty that he has violated the law, probably multiple laws. Mueller was clearly sending that message. I think it would be a good idea if Mueller came and testified before Congress, as Congressman Butterfield asked him to do. But, I mean, these members of Congress have sworn an allegiance to the Constitution. They have said they are going to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States when they took their office. And I think there's a strong argument to be made that it's impossible to do that unless you begin to look into whether the President of the United States has violated that Constitution.
And this is why we have elections every 4 years for the President of the United States.
But it's also why we have impeachment. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is part of the Constitution. It's not just about elections. If we'd waited till 1976 to vote Richard Nixon out of office.
If that's the intent to do it, then the Democrats should move forward with it.
Well, the Republicans should do it, too. There are Republicans who say we should.
Becky Gray is Senior Vice President at the John Locke Foundation. Rob Schofield is Director of NC Policy Watch. Enjoy your weekend.
Thanks.
Thanks, Jeff.